Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
And welcome to season 4, episode 38, Benji, of Undermine, brought to you by Osiris Media. I'm Tom Marshall, your tour guide, your fish tour guide, as we revisit, relive, redefine, underline, and of course, undermine Fish's prized Fall 97 tour. We're diving into each show of that tour on its 25th anniversary. And if you're just joining us, we began this season with 25 shows from the 90s that got us to this point. And so here we are blazing through the Fall 97 tour, show by show, song by song, moment by moment. And in real life, we go hurtling from birth until the end, and everything in between is just a blur of high chairs, seesaws, number two pencils, summer vacations, prom night, college dorms. And before we get to the wife, the kids, and the picket fence, there was Fish Tour. Fish Tour was in the 90s, and it was a moment that many of us lived before Big Cypress ushered in the new millennium and a change of scene. But here at Undermine, the moment never ends. Making use of the company flux capacitor that we have to share with the whole Osiris building here, we've set the Undermine DeLorean to December 2nd, 1997. So right now you're witnessing a trail of flames rising from the treadmarks as we suddenly race down Broad Street, Philadelphia, in the present past tense. It's December 2nd, 25 years later. The doors open DeLorean style, and out of the haze and dry ice from the passenger side, who's that striking silhouette that's emerging? Well, if you're joining us on YouTube right now, you already know that it's my co-host, Benji Eisen. And you also already know everything else above was just a metaphor. There is no real company flux capacitor.
Well, that's a damn shame.
And if you're listening instead of watching, that's Benji. Hi, Benji.
Hi, Tom. There's probably no DeLorean either.
No DeLorean.
Damn it. The next thing you're going to tell me is that we don't even have Smart Wool or Section 119.
I'm definitely not going to tell you that because we still do have product placement.
Well, okay. On the night we're talking about, Section 119 didn't even exist yet, so I don't need to be jealous of your donut threads, but I am anyway. Smart wool actually may have existed, but smartphones did not. Right. So if they did, if they existed back then, I would have this photo from the floor of the Philadelphia Spectrum where I was for the show. And instead, all I have is I have the ticket stub, and there's a black X scribbled on the back.
Oh, did you get an autograph from somebody?
No, I got a warning from a security guard. Any more dancing in the aisle, and I would have been 86th from the home of the 76ers. So, in addition to my ticket stub, I have some really strong memories of this night, not just of Phish at the Philadelphia Spectrum, but also of the late night show at the Disco Biscuits at the Theater of Living Arts. You know, as a matter of fact, Tom, in addition to all the other standout picture postcard memories that I have of this night, I believe that this was the fateful night when I handed you an Uno card that my friend Uno Clay gave me in the parking lot earlier on in the night.
You did. And I remember thinking, what the hell am I supposed to do with this? But it didn't really matter, actually, until several shows later when I started seeing more and more Uno cards. And then someone online made the assertion that Tom Marshall started the Uno card craze. And that's when I had to put my foot down and object. And I may even have said some terrible things about Uno cards. So I'm sorry about that. But in retrospect, over the years, I found out that people can say worse things about you online, and that Uno card rumors are probably pretty harmless.
I think Uno cards are probably pretty harmless, but it was a big night for me. You know, I handed you what essentially is just a card from a card game, and a totally arbitrary action that accidentally ignited a whole Uno card conspiracy theory. And then later on that same night, I escorted Mike Gordon backstage to Blaze with the Disco Biscuits, since I was in the odd position of I had credentials and he didn't. So I think now I've mentioned the Disco Biscuits as many times as I've mentioned Phish so far in this episode. And, you know, Tom, there's probably no reason for that whatsoever. Let me ask you this on the same thread. Tom, do you know who our guest is today?
Of course I do. And even though our listeners already saw his name in the episode title, today's guest is, of course, Mark Brownstein, a.k.a. Brownie from the Disco Biscuits. I also call him Mark. Mark is a member of Electron and Star Kitchen 2. Those are his other two bands. And it should be noted, he co-founded Headcount along with Osiris Powell, Andy Bernstein. And his pandemic pivot that's taking all his time now, all his creativity when he's not on stage or writing music, is his company Lively. And so he's got better things to do than just sit and wait for us in the waiting room.
That's very true. And, you know, I am absolutely looking forward to you bringing him in here and talking to him about this, you know, 12-297 show. But first, to our friends out there listening, if you're enjoying ourselves, then please help us to continue to entertain you by supporting the show via our new Osiris Premium offering. For what basically amounts to pocket change, you get bonus episodes of this show, as well as HF Pod, access to the entire Under the Scales catalog, ad-free episodes, meet and greets, and more. Check out osirispod.com/premium or click on the link in the show notes.
Thanks for saying that, Benji. I agree with everything you just said.
You know, Tom, one day I will quote you on that. But, well, you can go ahead and summon Brownie from the raging and debaucherous bad stage room that we don't really have. I'll take this opportunity to remind everyone that this season has been a really special opportunity to hear and to share stories from, you know, the tour where Phish destroyed America. So if you have your own Fall 97 thoughts, and if you were there, you definitely do, then please send them to us. You can do that by making a 1-minute video clip. It's got to be that short, but we will hear it as long as you post it on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, and tag Osiris Pod. You know, it's not really a contest, but one lucky entrant will win a handwritten copy of the lyrics to Ghost from our friend Tom Marshall.
And that's me. And this, for those watching on YouTube, is Mark Brownstein. Hi, Mark, and welcome to Undermine.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Superb. Hey, thanks for joining us, man. We'll just jump right in here. And we've been doing this with most of the guests from this season. And I know people will actually be interested in hearing your answer. Give us the context you had for Phish in 1997, starting with telling us, if you could, when your first show was and what you remember about it.
Oh, wow. That is some question. It's kind of a loaded question because for me, it's like I almost, when Benji asked me to come on this podcast to talk about Fall 97, I reluctantly agreed. And the reason was, sometimes they say a mark of a man is that he's able to sometimes admit that he's wrong, right? Or the mark of a human is that they're able to look back and admit that they were wrong about something. In this case, I got into Phish in 1992 heavily at college. I had known about them in 89, 90, 91 from being in the New York City music scene. They would come through and they played, I think, Wetlands once and I missed it. And they played like the Palladium on 14th Street, which was like right around the corner from my house. And one of my friends was like, I'm going to see Phish. And, you know, and I at that point it was like Fishbone. And they were like, no, Phish. And I was like, with a PH, right? So that was like what was happening then. And I got all the way to college and I hadn't seen Phish but I got really deeply into them my freshman year at Penn. And then by the sophomore year, so 1993 was my first show, and that was at Roseland in New York City, 2, 5, and 6, I think it was 1993, two nights at Roseland. And we've talked about this because that was right when Rift came out. Was like that was like the, I guess Providence was right before that, and this was like maybe the third and fourth show of the shows where they're playing the Rift album almost in its entirety over a two-night run. Mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing, life-changing, you know. Obviously, you know, if you were to objectively look at where I am and what I do and, like, you know, what my life has turned into, this was obviously like the pinnacle life-changing, you know, life-altering moment. You know, it's like they say that if you're like on a path and you're moved off of that path, even just a fraction of a degree, you know, over a long period of time, you're going to end up, you know, in a completely different place. And that certainly is true to this case. So then a lot of shows, 1993 in the fall, I did like, you know, McAllister Auditorium and the show where Dave Matthews Band opened for Phish in Pelham, Alabama, which was, I think it was Pelham or Oak Mountain Amphitheater, wherever that is, Pelham, yep. Alabama, which, I mean, I could do a whole podcast just on those two nights, you know what I mean? Like the story of like how the whole thing from the flight that was delayed all the way through, like not being able to find my tickets for McAllister at my friend's house to borrowing his car and almost killing his car in Pelham, Alabama. It was like wild, not even to mention the music, which was out of control. And it just gets, you're in a situation where through 1993, really all the way up into 1995, it just felt like every night was better than the last, right? It was like, how can they possibly be better tomorrow? And then they were better tomorrow. And to me, that was something I had never experienced with anything before, where I had come across a band that was so different every night, and it just was getting better and better. And like, I was going to see some Grateful Dead for context at that time. And, you know, that was for me past the peak of the Grateful Dead, and I just couldn't get into it. And Phish just had this thing that was, it was a trajectory, a rocket ship from, you know, those shows and with 2,000 people right into arenas, and then being able to kind of master the arena thing over those next couple of years. And, you know, I think it you know, arguably for a lot of people, they hit a peak on 12/31/95, which is just like, this is just unbelievable performance, right? And so for context, that's when the Disco Biscuits started playing, right? In like, you know, 95. And so we started to focus on our basement band, right? We were a basement band. We weren't even really playing shows. We would play like some fraternity shows through 95 and 1996. It started to pick up a little bit, and I was getting to see less and less Phish in 96, you know, as compared to it being the focus of my life in 1993 and 1994. Every break, everything was about where to get Phish. 1997 rolls around and I'm seeing even less of Phish, because now in the spring of 1997, we go on a 10 show tour, our first tour. And now, like, we're really focused on, this is a band, we're going to play shows. This is what, you know, I remember thinking, how are we going to get our own sound? Like, that's like, how does that even happen? And part of the thing is you have to stop going to see the things that are influencing you so much and, you know, focus more on your own thing. And
did you play Wetlands? Wetlands then on that tour?
Yes. So
I saw you on your first tour.
I think that our Wetlands show was in January of 1997, like January, like 29th or something of 1997. And then there was a smattering of them. We were coming through Wetlands, like, you know,
September, you were there
of 97.
Yeah. My birthday
September
show.
Of 97 and then 27th. Right, and then we were like, we were pining for like the post Phish shows, like 12/29, 12/30, 12, you know, those were the shows you really wanted to get if you were a young jam band at that point. And we didn't get it in 97. Mo and like Strange Folk, they all had those slots, but it was 12/29 and 12/30 of 1998, so we didn't even get there, that we finally got that Wetlands post Phish late night. And that was career trajectory changing kind of thing for us. But in fall of 97, I went to look through last night. I don't even know how many shows. I said to Benji five, but I think it might have been four, and I'm not even sure. There's only three that I can confirm definitely that I was at from looking at the set list. And that may sound weird, but it, like, with hundreds of shows and then another 1700 of Biscuit shows, it all kind of blends together, right? And so, like, when Benji asked to talk about 97, part of the reason I was reluctant was I wasn't connecting with it. The things were happening that were bothering me. And so just remember, to everybody who thinks this is crazy or you're an idiot or how can you even be saying this publicly, I've already stated up front that that I'm the type of person that can admit when I'm wrong. But there were things that I remember. So it's like the Maya Angelou quote, people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. Mm-hmm. Right. So, like, I have forgotten what Phish played through those shows, but I didn't forget how it made me feel. And how it made me feel was confused a little bit at times. There were things that were happening at every single show, and I couldn't wrap my head around things happening at every single show. And like, that was like, yes, there were certain things that you knew inevitably were going to happen at Phish, like a big kind of dissonant jam that came out into consonance on one peaky note, right? Like, you knew that this was going to happen at some point through the course of the show. And, you know, I think I was like almost like addicted to those moments. And then Phish comes out and slows everything down and starts like getting into the pocket. But there were little triggers for me, like the whammy bar delay loop at the beginning of the funk jams was like a signal that they were going to be doing a certain thing over the next 10 minutes or so. And I started to, as a fan, like react to that negatively. Like, it would happen, and I'd be like, oh, now I know the next 10 minutes are gonna have a funk jam, then there's gonna be a stop, and then like one of the guys, either guitar or like keyboards, is gonna play through the stop, and then they're gonna come back out. And, you know, it was almost like those moments were popping up in every jam. That's how I remember it, by the way. I've now listened, and I know that they were doing the smart thing. They were picking their spots and doing this new kind of jam. But like, to me, I saw four shows. It happened like eight times. And by the core states, like the Spectrum shows on 12/2 and 12/3, I had felt jaded for the first time as a Phish fan. I started to feel like I wasn't getting everything that I needed to get out of the show. And now, I'll pause for a second to say, I do recognize now that this was about me and not about what Fish was doing. Like all of this is like going on in your head, right? And it's like, I recognize now, like 20 years later, that this is like, it doesn't matter what I think, right? Like Fall, like I then come to find out 5 or 7 or 8 years later that Fall 97 is revered as the greatest tour of all time. And I'm thinking to myself, what did I miss? And I'll tell you what I missed. I missed great shows by one night. Four times. I missed the Runaway Gym in Worcester by one night. I missed like everything that people were coming out of the show and be like, last night was the greatest show I ever saw. And then I would go and the show wasn't the greatest. And that's the nature of Fish, right? So this is the nature of jam bands. It's the nature of improvisational music. Some nights are going to be the best and some nights aren't. And unless you go to all of them, you can't guarantee. But if you go to 4 or 5, you can roll the dice, you know, like that. You know you're going to like pretty much get something amazing. And you know what? I did. That's what I've come to find out, because I've gone back to listen to these shows and they were amazing. Right? Well, like they were amazing.
Yeah. And I think you nailed it in that, you know, your experience is not singular, and that a lot of people that I've talked, I mean, we've used the same language on this podcast in the past, saying, you know, there was a period where every night felt like Fish was a better and better and better band. And that may have ended after New Year's Eve 95, when every single night you walked out. And another surprise that we had on this season of Undermine is that there are certain shows that we learned that are historic. And at the same time, when we go back and listen to them, Tom will tell you that if he was there that night, he would have wanted a refund from his comp ticket. And you know, Brownie, I think you're actually talking about an experience that I had with you, because I remember raving to you about that Runaway Gym. And then the next night, the third night of Worcester, which was the preview show before the show we're about to talk about, was an anomaly. It was that heavy metal. And I mean, I loved it, but it wasn't for everybody.
Well, here's what's funny. When you said, can we talk about Fall 97? I said to myself, okay, what do I remember? I remember Bryce Jordan's show was like not that my favorite. It wasn't that strong of a show. Weird energy inside of the Bryce Jordan Center. I'm sure when I get to listen back to it, I'm sure it'll be great too, because it's Fish and it's all pretty good. Like there's moments of greatness in every show, obviously, and that stands true at this point. But I remember that. I didn't remember really much about the Core State show, just the Spectrum show off of the top of my head. But I remembered that in the show that I was at in Worcester, the lights turned off in the middle of something. I didn't remember what it was. And then they went into a heavy metal jam and started singing or saying the words of Sanity. I remember clearly
Wolfman's Brother.
And it was in this 31-minute Wolfman's Brother, which is really a great, great like piece of music, including the heavy metal part, is so out of the blue and different, and the Sanity and, you know, like funnily, like the thing that was most memorable to me musically about that whole entire run was them singing Sanity lyrics or saying Sanity lyrics over this heavy metal jam. I remembered that. I remembered the music of that clearly. Another thing that I remember clearly upon re-listen is the way that I felt during the Down With Disease in the Spectrum show, because it brought up a lot of these feelings that I was having about, you know, the peak, right? Like it's like all about these peak, you know, moments that you would get out of these Fish shows, like in 93 to 95, and every night was peakier and every night was faster and every night was better. And then like, you know, this was so different and it had a profound effect on me artistically that has a long, 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 long lasting effect for Disco Biscuit fans that they probably don't even know about, you know. And that was the Spectrum show. That's the show that you want to talk about, which is 12 too. And when Benji asked me, Tom, to talk about the Spectrum show, I said, can I talk about one of the shows that I like really remember? But it's funny, you know, going back and listening to the show, of course, it jogs your memory pretty quick.
I'm the same way as you. In many ways, what you're saying and what you said about the years prior to this, I mean, I never until this season of undermine. I never really had fall of 97 on my radar as that is Phish's best tour. And I don't even like think that way. I was never a tape collector. And so I completely understand everything you're saying, but I definitely had, and Benji referenced it already. I had probably a string of 3 years where I thought Phish was getting better every single time I saw them. And I was just like, this, I don't know anything else in the world like this. But for sure, I was there. We were probably right next to each other at the show.
We were next to each other so many times.
Must have been, you know, so many.
I mean, not must have been, were, because I know who you are. And like, you know, it's like you're a taller guy and it's like you stumble accidentally into like the friends and family, you know, 10th row at the man or whatever. And
try not to step on your best friend's feet.
Exactly. So I mean, I didn't know how the 92 to 95, like, you know, first generation 1.0, whatever we call it now, Phish fans felt about 96, 97. But what I do know is that Phish exploded in 97 and there was a ton of new fans, and to those people who came on right then for that next, like, you know, 6 years, Fall 97 is the grail, right? And there's a lot of people that Fall 97 is the grail for. And I've, you know, I like have a lot of respect for that. I've gone, like, I respect those fans' opinions enough to have gone back over the years and, you know, listen to a lot of the 97, the Nutter Center, a lot of the shows that people consider great, to and come to realize that I was just messed up in my head. Like, you know, I couldn't, like, it was different and it was great. It was just like hard to come from that better every night, like, stretch into what felt like maybe I didn't know if it was better every night.
They'd made a turn.
They made a turn.
Well, you know what's funny? What's funny is I don't remember the music, but it's like my memory of what was going on in that week. Like, I remember Benji clearly backstage with Mike Gordon at the TLA talking about the Runaway Gym from Worcester and comparing it to the 50-minute meet that Mo had just recorded and put out. And like, I think he was, I can't remember which one was longer, but I think Meat was longer and Benji was like, you almost beat Meat or whatever it was.
I remember that.
But I remember that. And I remember this amazing experience that I had, a friend who worked at the Spectrum named Melissa Wilson, who was friends with Mike. And over the course of that, like, Philly run, took me to the Four Seasons and brought me to Mike's room. And we went out to the bus. And I remember everything from that so vividly, all of the conversations that I had with Mike. And so it's like my memory of that week is, it's actually like objectively one of the better weeks that I remember of anything that's happened in my life. But like the music kind of blended together somehow. Oddly, like there's like outside of certain things, but it is a great show. 12 too. How do you go through it? What's your process?
Let's talk about that first set. I mean, it opened with Buried Alive and it had a wild segment right off the bat with Down With Disease into Makisupa Policeman, a short but incendiary chalk dust torture. And then a ghost that was like the first cow funk showcase of the night. Mark, sticking on this set, what did you think of set one?
Okay, so I had some issues with it, and like, again, that were issues with me, but like, here's the things that kind of were hard for me. First of all, Buried Alive was great. Like, I love a great Buried Alive opener, and it comes and it hits and it's great. And then the excitement at the beginning of Down With Disease was palpable, and the jam actually was a great jam. But then there's that moment in the jam where he goes into the reverse whammy delay, and I had thought at that moment, I was like, oh, we're going into like a cow funk section here, and I was admittedly jaded about the cow funk sections at that point. And I need to give you a little context. I'm from Manhattan, and and I went to jazz school in Manhattan at the New School for 2 semesters after my freshman year. While I was getting into Phish, I was learning about jazz from all these like jazz greats, right? Like the guys that a lot of them aren't alive anymore, because this is 1992. They were like Chico Hamilton and, you know, Reggie Workman, all these dudes. Some of them are alive. And jazz is my world, and classical too, you know, but like, this is my world. But there's all these like New York City bands, like even Boston bands that are playing at the Wetlands, like Mexican Mud Band and Chakra and The Authority, and who I love The Authority. They were my favorite band at the time, but nonetheless, like they were these funk, Milo Z, they were like funk bands that were based off of funk guitar chords, right? And I loved it. I was really deeply into the scene. I went to see all that stuff. But when I discovered Phish, they were musically to me on a different level than that. They were on this jazz classical level. And I put that on a pedestal over people trying to play funk from like the 70s now and the 90s. Like to me, it was like, oh, now there's people trying to play this funk music from the 70s and it's good, but it's like kind of watered down funk a little bit. The jam band scene funk and all the other jam bands, and the Sea Pods, Free Beer and Chicken, Percy Hill, they all relied on the wah-wah funk guitar as their like backbone. It was like the backbone of the jam band scene, and everybody, they all did it. You know, and we were like we kind of pushed against that. We like resisted against being a wah-wah funk band at that time, because that was like what it was, and we didn't want to be like everybody else. Then Phish comes along with like this heightened sensibility of jazz and classical music, and like compositional like beauty.
I can see where this is going. All of a sudden, then they drop into
suddenly
funk.
They're playing wah-wah funk guitar, which was what I was going not to see them for. I was going to them because they were not that. So now, listen, wah-wah funk guitar is the fucking greatest thing of all time. And like, you know, like at any time where I feel like there's a moment in the Biscuit Show where we're maybe straying too far or need a little bit of direction or need a little bit of a rhythm, I'll give Barber the like, look down at his wah-wah, or he'll just know, like he knows when to go over and get on the wah-wah and just center us and ground us in like a pocket. And that's now. I get it now because it's 25 years later and I've gone down a deep, deep hole, like, you know, deep into the funk hole, like, you know, over the last bunch of years. But at this point, I was trying to get away from it. So I hear that, whew, and Down With Disease, and I'm like, oh, here we go. But that, but I think even worse than going into the cow funk for me was they kind of petered the jam out and then kind of slipped into Maki Supa, which actually on re-listen is a sick transition. It's super cool, but that's not what I wanted. What I wanted was for them to take Down With Disease to the very peak of Down With Disease, come back in, play the guitar line and sing the chorus and play the end of the song. Yeah. Like that's the payoff of sitting through, you know, 17 minutes of guitar noodling. There's a payoff to all of this jamming, and they changed the formula. It was like, whoa, the formula is different here. Now, as an artist, 25 years later, I have the utmost respect for the conviction that it takes to change the formula and stick with it and actually prove that the early fans were wrong. Like, they're, you know, it's like that. Benji says maybe, maybe not.
Well, I mean, I don't think the early fans are wrong. Like, I remember in 97, it was almost like, Mark, with your band, I specifically and vividly remember that you guys were searching, to your credit, immense credit, and probably the, you know, in my mind, one of the biggest reasons why you achieved the success you did is you were searching for something original. But by doing that, I remember at the time electronic music, which wasn't something I was into, but some of the crowd that you were hanging out with was. And I remember you talking and having conversations with your bandmates about, hey, let's take this element and put this with this. And with Phish, to me, after 95, you know, I mean, that to me, maybe because that's when I got into them as well, as a similar timeline as you. And they were just
so you're jaded too. You're jaded in 97.
But it was a different way of looking at it, because in 97 it turned into a dance party.
And I was going to say, for your dance style, Benji, that cow funk is perfect. Became the bedrock upon which your Phish experience was built on, was that slow down funk. You and Carlin, the whole crew, if they would go into a funk beat, it erupts. It erupts.
Brownie, the dance moves you're talking about, it was from the MoMA dance. You know, it was because the band was playing cow funk that influenced.
And the MoMA dance came out of what was
Black
the song?
Eye Katie.
Black Eye Katie, which was kind of the jam that we're talking about.
That's exactly right.
Cow funk jam with the stops and stuff. Now, do they mark Black Eye Katie in the set list, or is that just like the jam that keeps popping up from show to show?
It's Black Eye Katie. Yep.
Okay. It had a name. Yep.
Okay. So, for me, like, it all sounded like Black Eye Katie at that point. Like, they would go into the cow funk and it was like they were playing Black Eye Katie again and again and again. And they didn't peak that disease. And for me, that was like a defining moment, because I remember the feeling of like wanting it. And then I was even thought maybe the end of disease is going to come back at the end of the second set. And I always view, or at the end of the first set. And I just always viewed that as a missed opportunity in that moment. Like, can you imagine how the spectrum would have erupted if, like, at the end of, say, you know, Taste, they started like, you know, working their way back towards disease, towards disease, and then peaked the disease out. I mean, it would have been, you know, pandemonium in that place had they done that, right? But like, you know, again, like, I'm not deciding what happens at a Phish show, but I do have that power at our own concerts. And right, so like, we took that moment and we were like, hey, listen, let's just remember to close things up at the end of the set. Just like, I remember wanting it. And then we were able to turn around and, you know, and
let's have a band, unlike Phish, that promises a payoff. We'll actually pay.
I don't know. I don't know. Phish has done pretty good for themselves. And
That tension and release is what, you know, is what drew so many of us in to begin with. And that payoff that payoff makes you a rich man if it happens.
So what do you think about the Chalk Dust, though? Do you think like the Chalk Dust had enough tension and release to take that? Like, for me, that was like the jam of the set. That was kind of like a 93, 94, 95 jam, right? It was, and I don't even know if it's considered a jam, but it's just like, it's a Chalk Dust.
It was a gem. And going back and re-listening to all these 97 shows, you know, we think of it as the Cal Funk tour, but they still displayed they had a bag of tricks. And so they added a new trick and they were focusing on the new trick because it was like getting a new toy where you want to play with it all the time. But they still used all of the bag of tricks that they had. And so they still would do tension and release jams. They still would have the humor. They still would have, Fishman would still come out and play vacuum solos. And they had all the elements of Phish. They just were adding to it. You know, Mark and Tom, I'm looking at the time and I'm about to take us to a break, but quick commercial break. But before we do it, Brownie, you mentioned the Taste in that set. And, you know, that reminded me that, Tom, for 25 years, this is an opportunity for me to put you on the hot seat, because for 25 years, I've wondered this. You wrote Taste, right? And then Fishman, I think, wrote Fog That Surrounds. And then the two were merged, you know, and it was the same music for Fog That Surrounds, and Fishman was singing it. And then we'll see where this ends up. But you write the song with Trey. Phish plays it throughout the summer of 95. And it's not an easy song to play. It's, you know, different instruments are playing different rhythms. It's pretty amazing. And then, complicating it further, during the first few versions of Fall 95, it completely shape-shifted into what seemed like an entirely different song with an entirely different name, you know, because Fishman took over the vocals with his own lyrics. When that happened, did Trey give you a heads up, or did you find out by surprise? Were you at a show and they start playing Taste and then Fishman starts singing and you're like, what's this?
It's kind of like, is it Vultures with Potato to the Throat? All of a sudden something all happened and I have no idea why, but you opened a huge can of worms here. And I think we should take that break so I can figure out my answer.
Fair enough.
I want to say, I did not know that Taste came. I forgot that Taste came before Fog that Surrounds. Cause I remember seeing Fog That Surrounds. Oh no. Cause I saw it in Jones Beach, Fog That Surrounds, and I was confused. I remember the confusion.
And I think, I think there's confusion, and I think it's based on listening to Benji ask that question. I think there's a mistake in there, but let's address it.
Let's take the break.
Hey listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's DistroKid with a capital K.com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's DistroKid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.
And we are back. We are here with the Disco Biscuits, Mark Brownstein, and our mutual friend and co-host, Benji Eisen, who just asked me about Taste, the song Taste, turning into Fog That Surrounds before it turned back into Taste. And like I said before, I think there was a misconception that Fish wrote a song that was combined with Taste. I don't think that really ever happened. Now, I can't explain why suddenly there's a song, Fog That Surrounds, and even one called Taste That Surrounds. I guess different performances were given different titles, but to me, they're all Taste. So let me tell you what I think happened. Scott Herman, and my lyric writing pal, and I had given Trey a book filled with hundreds of poems and poem fragments called The Salamander Prince. And Trey used this to fuel his songwriting all the way through Ghost and Farmhouse. And then we gave him another book called Walls of the Cave with more songs, but that's another story. But so for the recording of Billy Breathes, Fish got really experimental in the studio with Steve Lillywhite and John Sickett, and they created this long, amazing piece of music they called The Blob. And it was really cool. And eventually Swept Away, Steep, Taste, and I think Prince Caspian, and possibly a few more songs that never saw the light of day, came out of that primordial blob of music. But they needed lyrics. So Trey just threw his copy of Salamander Prince into the room and the band like grabbed it and started going through it. And it was the first time the band members had access to Scott's and my poems. And so they later used it for like Frankie Says and some other songs too. But anyway, back to Taste. I wrote all those lyrics, but I do think they came from two separate poems. And maybe Fish brought the second poem into the song Taste. Or maybe he was just the singer of that second part. But either way, the part that causes the controversy in Taste is the part that Fish sings. And it's after the I'm out, and I will stay here alone without someone controlled by the phone and TV, because what it's doing to me is fine, because I can see through the lines. So right after that, it goes into the controversial part, which is, ooh, ooh, step into space. But I kind of figure out what's happening. I went back and figured out what's happening. So he's singing every other line of a poem that I'd written the full thing, but he only took his parts out. So I think at one point Trey was probably doing a back and forth with him where he would sing one line and then Fish would sing the other. But what wound up in Taste was just Fish's half. So Benji, I just sent you the original poem, and I was thinking maybe we could help people make sense of this if I do Trey's line, which didn't wind up in Taste, and you do Fishman's line, and we'll read the whole poem.
If it's the just the lyrics that Fishman sings, I can probably do it by heart, but okay, I'll pull this up.
Okay, here goes. So this should make sense. The lines I read never wound up in the final song.
One question before we start this. You said earlier when you were singing the lyrics, because I can see through the lines. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. There's always this ambiguity to me in that it was, I can see through the light. I can't see through the light. I can see through the lies.
I think the line TV, like someone controlled by the phone and TV, but I can see through the lines of the TV to the other bigger picture.
I always assumed it was, I can see through the light.
Through the light. Yeah.
That's a fine misinterpretation as far as I'm concerned. All right.
I've been misinterpreting you for 25 years.
And we're coming into our 40th year of misinterpretation coming up.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. I'm going to read you Trey's part, which didn't make it in the song. Benji's part is what is in Taste. Okay. Down on myself again.
Step into space.
Wondering how I can
alter my place
in this hall of creation
that someone else made.
Who's probably wondering
why I have stayed
and never progressed
into things I could be
if I found the right partner
or if I could see
beyond my four walls
into fog that surrounds
my need for redemption
pins me to the ground.
So if you take out just every other line like Fish did, it becomes
now
this bizarre.
Are we sure there's not a version out there where I think we got to go back and start listening to the early versions of Taste? Because I would like to find a version where the whole poem is in there.
The very beginning of Fall 95, when fans, myself included, when we were calling it the fog that surrounds, it was, it had all the lyrics that we just went both parts that Fishman sang. And because Fishman sang it, It was a popular, I guess, misconception now, but that I've had until today, and that's that Fishman must have written those lines and co-opted the song for his own purposes.
Well, I got to tell you that I was going to 100% go and find that, because in my head, there was no way that I hadn't heard your lines before, Tom.
Okay,
I was 100% to the point where I heard them coming before you said them, so...
I got used to the studio version of Taste that became the definitive version for me. And that doesn't have those. Maybe I never heard Fog That Surrounds or Taste That Surrounds. Maybe they had them playing in the Midwest somewhere. Anyway, so I guess versions with all those lyrics have been played and have been called things other than Taste. But to me, they're just different versions, different incarnations of Taste.
Yeah, it's all Taste to me too. It feels like it felt like it was just Taste. They kept changing the name, and they needed to. That, like as a fan, it felt more like they were trying to figure out what the name of the song was.
Yeah.
Than that the song was dramatically changing.
Well, it's a wild ride. Tom, you wrote it, and I will have you know that Fish.net notates the evolution as Taste, and then Fog That Surrounds, and then Taste That Surrounds. But then by this night that we're talking about, 12/2/97, it's back to Taste again, with that extra Fishman verse that we just did, the lines that I was doing.
Oh.
And, I re-listened to the show, of course, the other night, and it's a great Taste. It's typical of Taste in that it's typically great. It doesn't... it's typically straightforward, but it still is just a phenomenal song and what all the instruments are doing. It's a first set song.
Yeah, and to your point too, Benji, it's like just goes to show like how your memories can be skewed over the years, because like they hit Taste here and they just hit it perfectly, right? And like and even Dirt before it, and even Divided Sky before that, like really if you want to go through the whole set, like the Ghost had the cow funk. And the only thing that listening back, I would have said to myself, like I would have liked again for Ghost to have come back around and finished rather than kind of, I guess, not like jarringly, because it sounded like the jam just kind of went major. And then suddenly, like about two bars later, it's like, oh, wow, we're like in Divided Sky here, you know, and then they nail Divided Sky. I mean, nail it. Right. And it's like these were the days when you could count on Divided Sky just being perfect every time. And like as a fan, that perfection of these incredibly intense compositional sections is what, I mean, in a lot of ways drove me as a musician to try to continuously get better, because you're seeing these people doing like the seemingly impossible, right? And then Dirt, Dirt hit, and I'm like never not a fan of a first set Dirt. And then Taste was perfect, but like objectively, it wasn't like a blow it out, you know, first set. Would you consider this like a blow it out, like over the top? Wow, I can't believe how great this first set was. Or is it, this is a good set?
I think it was a good set. I think, you know, and there's different ways of judging it. But if you look at like which songs have been recognized with a jam chart, they all occur in the second set of this show. There's like four that have the extra analysis that Jam Charts affords. And that's something on fish.net. And there were none in that first set, even though I, like you, Mark, I like the first set quite a bit. But we took our set break already. So let's dive into set two.
Yeah, set two.
Yeah. So Mark, the meat of this second set is a segued Mike's Groove that has the pretty wild sequence of Mike's Simple, Dogface Boy, Yamar, and then finally Wicked Pog. And none of these versions you could call normal. What were your thoughts about that night?
Well, I like the tension in Mike's song. I like the sort of understated peak that they hit, and it wasn't like an over the top like tension release like into a massive like one note and maybe even like replay that out three times to like a bigger one note, and then ultimately you like the note where you're like, oh, I thought we hit the note, and then you're like, oh, I thought we hit the note, and then it's like, here's the note, it's undeniable.
That's like 2001.
This is the one.
That's like 2001.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. And so they did like kind of a tension thing, and then they come up in this in before the segue into Simple, they hit like a note, but it's not like the biggest one you've ever heard. And then they drop back down into like that F sharp, right? And it almost sounds like they're about to go right there into whatever's coming next. Who knows what's going to come next? Simple is a good guess, though. If you're at the show, you know, you at this point you think Simple might be the thing, and but no, they don't. They kind of wind it back up again, and then it starts to get out there, like kind of dissonant, and then ultimately it drops down into Simple. And the thing about Simple that is, Simple's an epic, beautiful song, but it's a reverse peak, right? Like it starts kind of at this high place, and then the jam like consistently goes down in energy and down in energy and down in energy, right? And that's like the opposite of what Fish's formulaic, you know, improv was. And this was kind of the first song that Heather was brought into the, I mean, maybe the only song that I could think of in Fish's catalog. I admittedly don't know their later catalog as well as I know the early catalog, but where they started high up in a glorious kind of peaky place and then went in the other direction.
I never thought of Simple that way. It does make sense. Like it's like triumphant in the beginning. We've got it Simple, and then we got it.
Well, especially on this night, because you know, one of the hallmarks of the funk was when, you know, one of the hallmarks of this tour was when people would drop out of the jam, right? And all of a sudden, it just be too. And in this Simple, in a very understated way, there's this section where it is Trey and Paige, and it's not like in Ghost or, you know, one of these big moments when all of a sudden it's very obvious that everybody drops out except maybe, you know, Mike and Fish or Paige, and, you know, instead it wasn't a breakdown.
That's a breakdown. In Ghost, it's a cow funk breakdown, right? That was like the, right? This wasn't, I mean, this is technically considered a breakdown, But it flowed naturally out of the simple into like kind of the two of them just jamming, right? But go back and listen to some simples from like the very beginning through those first couple of years. Like they formulaically brought the energy down throughout the course of the jam in a very beautiful, methodical, you know, simple way. But it wasn't the start at the bottom and work your way up to a peak. And so I didn't know where the set was going to go at this point. Right. And then Dogface Boy kind of throws you for a loop in the middle of a second set. Right. I'm like, okay, but it's Dogface Boy and you're doing it. The Yamar actually, like, the jam gets really sick. Like, it's like Yamar goes in some places. And I think, what happens next was what threw me for the loop the most in the set, which was they jammed Yamar pretty seamlessly back into Weekapog, but they're playing Weekapog at a very slow tempo, very slow. And almost you don't notice how slow it is until, you know, so they come into Weekapog. Trey plays the chords, right? Like the four times, and then they start singing it. And when they're singing it, you could really feel how much slower it is than a regular Weekapog, almost to the point where it's like a different song, but it's beautiful and cool and different. But I can see myself at that time, like just wanting to hear Weekapog the way Weekapog's supposed to be. Right. And like, I know, like myself as a fan, I like Weekapog is the payoff. Now we're talking about the payoff again. You go through Mike's Hydrogen or Mike's, you know, Jerusalem or Mike's, you know, Simple or whatever goes in the middle there in between Mike's and Weekapog. And there's something, you know, fun and weird and, you know, dynamic. Most importantly, like that's the thing about the Mike's Weekapog. It's like Mike's is dark, right? And sick. And then whatever happens in the middle, it's dynamic. It's not meant to be like the peak of the set. It's not. It's the antithesis of that intentionally. It's the spot where your friend, you know, hands you a bowl or a cigarette if that's what was your thing back in the 90s or like whatever. Everybody takes a drink and whatever it is, that's your moment to take a breath. And then it stops and Mike comes in with Weekapog and it's like crazy fast and furious and energetic. And this Weekapog was decidedly not fast. And actually the end of this Weekapog was faster than like a regular Weekapog. It starts slower than a regular Weekapog and it ends faster. And I can tell you from being in a band why that is. It's because when you're not starting it from scratch with the person who starts it, like setting the tempo every time, you're feeling the tempo out. And so if you're slower, when you hit those changes, you're slower. And I think they did the right thing and let it like not just immediately speed it up and like let it be what it was. But when you're speeding up to find the tempo, it's very easy to pass that tempo. Like, you know, like finding the right spot while you're speeding up, it tends to blow past that.
You tend to overshoot. Like, that's cool.
Yeah, but the end of this Weekapog actually is very fast. It's like I don't know, I got to go with a BPM, but it's like sounds like it's above 140, maybe even as fast as 150 or 160 beats per minute, which like the Biscuits have a lot of peaks in that range, like, you know, Basis for a Day and Munchkin Invasion and Above the Waves, where like it's those are like the faster songs, the faster peaks. And I you know, as a disco Biscuit, I really appreciate how fast that Weekapog got. And like, you know, and it was shredding, right? Like
it sounded for a moment like they were gonna go into Isabella.
Yeah, I didn't hear that because I'm not as heady as you, but like, you know.
Yeah,
you know, like I didn't hear that, but like
there's a distinct moment there.
On the faster side. Okay, on the faster side. I mean, it really ramps up. And for me, like that moment where it goes from slow to fast is like the pinnacle moment of this set. That's the moment that like hit me and like the okay, here we go. Here we go. Like, you know, and it's like, I don't want to sound like the only thing I want them to do is peak. Certainly I don't. Like, I like the journey as much as the destination, you know, like that's as an improv musician, I pr- almost prefer the journey part as I do to the peak part. And as a fan, you know, like the real magic occurs in the journey.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. And the peak is just a, it's just like a way to wrap it up and cap it and say
it's
we're
the
done.
Exclamation mark. Yeah.
It's how you say we're done. It's the end of the set. So they really did just an incredible, incredible job coming out of that slow week of Pog into that fast week of Pog. And I mean, if you want to hear a week of Pog that's a little too slow and a little too fast, this is your week of Pog, right? This is the one. I mean, and I'd say like the Yamar, you know, the combination of the simple and the Yamar and the like, what are the jams? The what are the four that go on to on the, what do you call it? The jam chart.
Or
the and what are the four that are on the jam charts?
Bike, simple, Yamar, Bikes. And Wickapug. And I think Dogface was even mentioned as being unusual and
the most unusual Dogface boy that I know of.
Yeah, and being beautifully segued into and out of.
Yes. Beautifully segued into and out of, right? And very unusual.
Yeah.
But in like unusual in a way that almost like was confusing. Like, again,
well, normally like, it's like, you know, to me, it's an acoustic song or a very quiet song. And this one had the whole band. And I think even Trey might have surprised the band when he started to sing it against those chords. I think he got them used to it one time around. He played the chords to let them know something was coming, and maybe they picked it up. They probably did, but I didn't.
I remember being very confused by it when they started singing it, because you know, you don't recognize that that's what it is until you know, in the hindsight, but because it's a different tempo and the just everything about it, it's an alternate version of it that was kind of invented and made up on the spot. And then, not that we need to do
almost like the sanity the night before the show before, right? It was like almost like this is what Trey was doing in these improv sections, was like, you know, reinventing songs.
That's exactly
in the middle of these jams
and bits and pieces of them, which of course the distributors are so adept at. Now, you know, not that we need to do the play-by-play, because this podcast is more about the color commentary, but then we have the bouncing around the room, and then Chalk Does Torture puts the exclamation mark on
character
on
zero.
Thank you. That's what I meant. Yeah, character
zero.
Yeah,
and I feel like it's an interesting choice for them to then, after that week of Pug, which, you know, arguably could have been the end of a short set. Like, at that point in the set, I was like, wow, we're done, right?
And they were doing four song second sets on this tour. They were only an hour
long. We were done. I was halfway out the door. I was like, but I felt like after that, because like bouncing and character zero and sample all kind of fit into like the heady fans like bucket of like, you know, like poppier songs that, you know, maybe that not everybody's looking forward to. Like happy, love all three songs, happy to hear any of them at any point in any set, right? But they're not the big improv like launch pad, they're just like the, it's not the highlight of the show, it's just a nice. But and they're great filler songs.
They're
right?
Also
like these
great
are,
fish songs. You know, they're great fish songs. They're calling cards saying this is what we do. But then live,
maybe one of them in a set. Right. Like, so seeing three come in rapid succession like that at the very end of the show, like I, like as a fan, I was a little confused there too. I was like, oh wow, that was like a weird ending. Like after that crazy jammed out set, they kind of decided to just turn on a dime again and not do any more jams and just straight up like bouncing character zero, ginseng sample. And, you know, at the show, it's fun and like sing along, you know, I'm singing all of the songs on replay, even better. Like, you know, like even better on replay. It's like I'm definitely singing it all. And, you know, but it's a long fish. Fish is a long show, right? Biscuits are a long show. Like jam bands are a long show. And sometimes you might, as a musician, I can say like sometimes you might get to that point where it's like we've played four jam chart worthy jams in the last hour and 15 minutes. It's time to put an exclamation point on the set with a bouncing character zero. And, you know, I don't think like, I think like arguably they could have just done character zero out of after Week of Pog and been like, oh, here's that. This will definitely be the set closer, right? You know that if they play bouncing, something else is going to come after that. Right. But they could have, they didn't have to play the bouncing, which actually is nice because it's almost like a double encore kind of vibe. It's like a double encore at this show, right? Well, like Weekapod's like the end of the set, and then they do like a double encore, then they go off and do another double encore. That's kind of really what happened here.
Mark, you talked about how jam bands like to have long shows, and jam band podcasts can be long too, and we're getting there, but there's a few more questions that we just need to ask you very quickly for the exclamation mark at the end here. And that's that, you know, this is something that I actually can't wait to hear what you have to say about it, because I know that you have a wonderful memory of Mike Jordan from I think the 2 days, because you were at one point, I think you were on the bus with them or in the hotel room. Can you tell us the story about him introducing you to quote unquote the funk?
So this is the kind of, this is like the culmination of everything that happened on fall of 97 tour. Although there was still Bryce Jordan Center to come on the 9th of December after this. But the culmination was I was jaded, but not jaded enough to jump at the chance immediately to go hang out with Mike Gordon. When my friend called me and said, "Hey, you want to come hang with Mike Gordon?" I was like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Well, of course I do. And so I head down to the city, you know, the old Four Seasons down on Benjamin Franklin Parkway. And I remember this experience like so vividly, but like,
when
you know,
was
right
this?
Down.
When?
So that, I think this had to have been the day off, either before the show or after the show. I don't remember which one, but it was like a day off because everybody was milling about. You know, the band was like milling about.
It would have been right before. It would have been between Worcester and this show, December 2nd.
Day off between Worcester. And here's what happens. We go into the room and he's got a little basket on his bed, and in the basket is like his folded like underwear and t-shirt like that they did. And I'm like, wow, these guys are fucking rock stars. They get a they get their laundry done and brought in a basket and put on their bed, right? It's, you know, we sit down and we start talking about music, and He tells me that his favorite band, he's like, "I'm going to put my favorite band on for you right now." Great. So he puts on the Grey Boy All-Stars. And I'm like, "Grey Boy All-Stars. I love the Grey Boy All-Stars." You know what I mean? Like, saw them at Wetlands with that was the name of the band. I don't even remember who they opened for. That's how good they were, right? It's like when they were like, they stole the show there at that Wetlands show. And, he like gives me his bass and, you know, hands me his bass, and his friend's there, and he's like, starts quizzing me like pop quiz, but like remediary questions. Like, what's the second most important note in the scale of the bass? And I'm like, the five. And he's like, "That's right, the five." And I'm like, "Oh, thank God I got the Mike Gordon quiz right." You know what I mean? And I just kind of like, you know, plucked around on the bass, probably did a little slap and a pop or whatever bass players do to show another bass player that they're like, you know, have some semblance of an idea what they were doing, which, by the way, I did not. You know, I had been to music school, but I was learned how to play upright bass in music school. And so like, I literally went to music school, learned a bunch of theory about jazz, and then came back and still didn't know how to play bass, and like had to learn. I had to learn on the road. And that's like, you know, 95, 96, 97. So I'm really just learning this instrument at this point. But he was so nice to me. Like, he was like, you know, he was like really like welcoming and mostly so focused on music. Like, I remember that, like, Mike is solely focused on music and our like conversations. And then he's like, "Yo, you want to head out to the bus, smoke some weed?" And I was like, "Do I ever?" Like, you know what I mean? Like, young Phish, I'm 24 years old, and Phish is my favorite band for the last 5 years. I've seen like 80 shows, and the bass players inviting me as like a contemporary musician to come with him and smoke weed on the bus. And, you know, it was such a, you know, crazy experience. We walked downstairs, pages on the street. Right? And like we walk out, and he's like, "Oh, Paige, how's it going?" And Paige is like, "Hey," they introduced me to Paige. I'm like, "I can't believe I'm meeting Paige right now." And the only time I think I've really ever met Paige was right there. You know, I've been around him a bunch of different times, but you know, I to be honest, I try not to talk to fish. Like I've been around the guys a lot and have talked to Mike, you know, the most of anybody in the band. But like, I find this is going to sound weird, 'cause like everybody's always trying to become friends with the other musicians that are like, you know, that I want to keep fish on a pedestal. I want to keep fish like not, I don't want them to become my friends. I've never wanted that. Like, I know, like, you know, I have friends who are friends with them and easily can like kind of push the issue, but I just kind of have decidedly pulled back from that, you know. And if I ever see them, I just don't bother them. Like, you know, I saw Mike on the street in Jazz Fest last year, and like, you know, he stopped to say hi and we talked for 30 seconds and he went on his way. And it was like, you know, another time at Jazz Fest, we like really got a good hang at a show. And like, it's like, if that happens, great, but I'm not trying to push this issue with my favorite band. They are my favorite band and I want them to be, I want to be a fan. It's like, I want to keep that fan creator relationship sacred.
I like that you became friends with Mike though. You know, the bass players are pals. That's cool.
It's just the one, he's the guy that's there. Like, he's the one that comes out. He's the one that shows up. And like, you know, I've ended up. So let's go back to so we're walking up, the buses are like in the middle of the parkway, right? And we like have to go out and he's like entering his code. I've never been on a tour bus before, right? And we go in the tour bus and we go like through, walk through the bunks, right? And we sit down in the back and I like, amazingly, like, I don't think they're at the point yet in their career where they each have their own tour bus, right? Nope, they're all in this tour bus together.
Yep.
And which is wild to me, like thinking that they're playing like MSG and like and the Spectrum and they don't have their own buses, because now there's no band plays like arenas of that size and doesn't everybody have their own bus. But it's the fact was, that was what led to this whole Cowfunk thing, right? This is the insight that I got from Mike, which I feel so special to have had this experience. But he sits me down and he takes out this little glass bowl and packs it with like some weed and hands it to me. And he's like, "So, you know, after every show, this is what we do. We come back here into this back lounge," and he like presses this VHS tape into this VHS machine. He's like, turns the thing on. He's like, "We got this video here," and Fishman makes the whole band watch the whole entire video every single night. "You want to watch it?" And I'm like, "Yeah, like, do I want to sit with Mike Gordon in the back of the Fish tour bus and watch the video that he watches with his bandmates after every single show every night?" Like, and if this ever gets back to Mike, like, I apologize if some of these details might be fuzzy or whatever, but like, everything I'm saying is how I remember it. We sit kind of in silence because now he got stoned and I got stoned. And so like now it starts to get a little awkward because I am a big fan of his and now I'm stoned and he's stoned and we stop talking really. And we just zone in on this video and he plays this whole video. It's like 45 minutes or like an hour, you know, packs a bowl once or twice more. And we sit down there and like in the middle of the video, they're like playing, it's James Brown, by the way. Reveal.
Yeah, what's the video?
The video is a live James Brown performance. And it's this incredible live James Brown performance where it's like all, you know, like if you know James Brown at all, it's like, it's heavy James Brown. It's like, you know, with the JBs and the whole entire thing. But there's this one section of the video where they're all in the funk and they're just sitting in the funk. And then James Brown like calls like, you know, a breakdown, like breakdown, 2, 3. And then the whole thing breaks and the guitarist starts playing like funk guitar by himself. And then they come out of it, boom, you know, and he's like, this is like the section that, you know, we're all like trying to like mimic when we're, and he was basically said like, we're watching this and we're making an attempt to slow ourselves down and play funk authentically by, you know, copying the master you know, and like, how can you argue with that? Right. It was like, once it was, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, like this is an attempt to incorporate a different style of music that we are maybe aren't the best at playing or weren't the best at playing or just never like did this before, but we're copying a James Brown performance into our shows every night. And that was like that was like the inspiration for all of this cow funk, you know, according to Mike, you know, of course.
Well, Trey just said the same thing. Yeah, we just interviewed Trey and he said the same thing. He mentioned specifically the bus parties and that James Brown was the fuel for those parties. He said the exact same thing. Yeah, so you're vindicated, validated, all the V words.
I remember it so, I remember it so vividly. And it's like funny to listen back to the show and be like, I can like hear Mike's voice, all the words that he was telling me about this James Brown thing, because it was shattering for me. It was like earth shattering, like, oh God, this is what's going on. This is why you guys have changed. And they hadn't even really changed. They were just like once or twice a night, we're doing this thing. And I relate deeply to this because the Disco Biscuits really haven't changed either. But like we do our tractor beam jam in the second set for like a year or two, where it's like we take a spot and it's like our drum space, but our drum space is like a composed house mix of like from like a like Carl Cox set or something. We'll take like 10 minutes of a Carl Cox house music DJ set and we'll learn it note for note and then we'll play it. And it, to us, it's like banging. It's house music. We pick great segments, learn them note for note and perform them, but it becomes like predictable that's going to happen in the show every night. And then, you know, like, you know, so I relate deeply to like being like inspired by something musically and then like changing what you're doing in a very small part of a 4-hour show. And then having fans like me be like, what are they doing? And then like, you go back and listen. It was like for like 17 minutes out of 4 hours, they put this one thing in that became a little bit predictable and it affected my whole experience on that tour. And like, you know, it gives me empathy for the fans who go through this with the Disco Biscuits when we like try to make a big change and and the fans like resisted or like, you know, have like resistance to what we're trying to do. I have like an intense, deep amount of like empathy and connection for what they're going through. And, you know, and I just like, you know, I guess I would say like put some context on it and like, you know, listen back, you know, most of what's happening is what happened here was what I was going for. Like they did deliver. The payoff was there, but something was wrong with me. And, but you know, like, sense. Again, totally it seems like sense. Something was wrong with a lot of us, Benji. It seems like we were all having this internal struggle about like what our favorite band was deciding to do. Yeah. And you know what you get to eventually is, you know, you're a fan. You don't get to decide.
Yeah, well,
you get
to, yeah. Mark, we are, I'm keeping an eye on the time and we do have to wrap up. However, no, there's one just one or two more questions that I think that Tom and I have to ask. And that is, there's just on this exact same thread that you're talking about, even though it, we're making a jump, but jumping ahead by 24 years, actually jumping ahead by more than 4,000 years, technically. I was with you and some of our, you know, lifelong friends to witness the one and only time that this band Sci-Fi Soldier has ever performed on planet Earth. You know, and we had masks on at the time, but I still remember seeing you smile from underneath the mask. What were some of your thoughts on Sci-Fi Soldier, just very quickly?
Yeah, so when I realized that Phish was going to play a set of music, you know, not unlike Cascot Boxed, where they were creating a new band and creating all new music and going to play it for an arena full of people. Again, you know, like not as courageous as like going to war, but like on like a creative artistic level, a courageous, you know, brave move to do something like that. And I had gone through the mental process of seeing Cascot Vox, you know, what was that, 2 years or 3 years previous to that, in the same room, in much the same situation, me brought out to Las Vegas for my own performances after Fish and having an opportunity on one of the four nights to get to go to the show, the 31st, which is typically the night that we take off on that Fish run. We'll play the first three. And so I've had a chance to go to that fourth and see whatever the shenanigans that they pull are. I went into that set with a mindset of I am accepting whatever this is going to be a moment where I put aside all of my own preconceived notions about Fish, all of my own expectations about what I am going to a show for, what I hope to get out of it. I'm putting everything aside and I'm just going to find the pocket and dance and have a great time no matter what it was. And if you were able to go into that set with that mindset, it was super funky, kind of like the Halloween stuff that they were doing. What's the one that they do in Atlantic City where they wrote a bunch of new songs for?
Wingsuit.
The Wingsuit. Yep.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, where like all the, well, there was another one though. Were there two in Atlantic City?
You think
there was
Chilling Thrilling?
Chilling Thrilling. Right. You know, like Chilling, there's just Chilling, like a lot of weird stuff was happening and it's all new and different. I found that there were some really funky, like just like this is Fish pockets. Right. And whereas Castle Box, I really like wasn't sure what was going on. Like I truly was like in the school of people that were like, is this real? Is this not real? I never figured it out. I was confused and like, what is going on here the whole entire time? And I was, you know, there were certain songs that really connected with me in Cascade Box, you know, that they still play. But yeah, I loved Sci-Fi Soldier. I loved it. And it's funny because we are working on like a space opera as well. That is not from the future per se, but or is kind of from the future, but is an alien space opera that the Biscuits are sort of characters in. And we've been working on it forever. You know what I mean? Like since way before we started it about, I don't know, 5 months before Sci-Fi Soldier happened, we started working on a Disco Biscuit space opera. And then Sci-Fi, and then Fish, you know, of course, they did it.
Yeah. Of course.
But it was, I mean, it was great. It was such a fun time. I can't, like, now I'm at a point now where if like I'm looking for them to like just like find some funk pockets and like, you know, and let me get my Benji eyes and like, you know, spin dance on, you know what I mean? Because I, by the way, something you may not know about me is I have adopted Benji's dance for myself at Fish shows because it's just a perfect kind of groove, right down to every now and then doing a little bit of a spin of the hat.
I was better off not knowing that, I think.
I don't adopt his dance, but we do every now and then. I don't know if it would.
I have to be the arbiter, the time arbiter now. We've not doubled our normal time. We've tripled our normal time allotment. So we do have to. So you win the prize, Mark. You win the absolute prize. But that's going to do it for us today. Do you agree, Benji? Or,
right.
or is there
yeah,
one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for letting me ramble on.
Thank you, Mark Brownstein, for revisiting December 2nd, 1997 in Philly with us.
Hey, Tom.
Yes, Benji.
One more thing. You just said December 2nd, 1997 in Philadelphia.
Ah, I sure did.
Well, it's now that we talked about 12-2 Philly, we have to very briefly, or else RJ's going to kill us, we have to talk about 12-11 just outside of Philly.
Yeah, 25 years and 1 week later, December 11th, 2022. We're all over the place.
Well, not really. We are in the 215. We are on the Philly Main Line. But we are going back to the future because that will still be 9 days away from when this airs. So your stroll is no longer snapped in half from all the time travel. Where will we be? What am I talking about?
Okay, so you and I and RJ and Mark too, if we can convince him, we'll be in Ardmore, PA on December 11th for a special Undermine live taping as we celebrate the elaborate conclusion of this season.
Elaborate is right. Well, you know, we'll be there. RJ will be there. Megan from HF Pod will be there. And a bunch of Jamrock All-Stars will be there performing a set of Jamrock and Cowfunk, inspired by Fish's Fall 97 tour. It's members of Pink Talking Fish, Dogs in a Pile, Twiddle, maybe some Disco Biscuits, but no promises there. We have to convince them first.
Well, will you do that? No, not yet. He hasn't said yes yet
nothing
either.
Yet. Nothing yet. We have to convince them.
We'll go to work on Mark off mic. But by the way, Mark has already participated in an Osiris live show at the Ardmore Music Hall in the past. But to recap, we are going to be there live on Sunday, December 11th, for our final podcast of this Undermined season, with tons of live music and not too much talk, we promise. The link for tickets is in the show notes. Thank you, Mark Brownstein, and thanks to the invisible Osiris team that makes this all happen. And I do have to give a nod to our sponsor, Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. So if you have a ticket you don't want or want a ticket you don't have, try your luck at cashortrade.org before going elsewhere. Coming up next, night two of Fish's Fall 97 Philly shows. We will see you back here tomorrow. And until then, as they say in Philly, no deals. All right. Thank you so much, Mark. And thank you, Benji.
Invite me at your own risk.
Okay, great. You might come, which is great. I think that means on December 11th, we might be seeing members of the Disco Biscuits too. All right.
No promises.
All right. No promises. All right. Oops. See you guys.
Bye-bye.
Osiris. Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolfpack, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.